Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
A few weeks after I first started primary school in Clondalkin, the teacher took me Ma aside for a word in private. "It's about his reading," she said. Ma was somewhere between aghast and insulted. "You'll have to stop teaching him to read yourself. He's too far ahead of the others. It's making him bored and fidgety." Despite the rebuke, Ma was flattered. She often repeats that story to me and others with pride. She wasn't long an adult then herself. She got pregnant at just 17. But she was a great Ma. A few years ago, I found prima facie evidence of her pedagogic misdemeanour in the form of copybooks in a box of old papers. Taking it upon herself to begin my initiation into the arcane lore of letters, my Ma had marked the outline of the alphabet with dots in the copies. My infantile wayward scrawl joined the marks to reveal capitals, A, B, C, and so on. The pattern she marked was as perfect as if it had been printed. My own line followed it like the track of a drunkard stumbling back from the pub, veering off the path but guided back in the direction of home by some pigeon-like instinct. My Ma's influence always brought me back to writing. Having taught me to read in advance, she bought me books in advance of my capabilities too. I still have a beautiful hardback copy of Lewis Carroll's Logic Bending, Alice Through the Looking Glass, a book designed to defy comprehension, which she gave to me when I was 5. At that age, I was probably still stumbling through the mundane adventures of Anne and Barry. Inscribed inside the front cover is "To Fran, Love Eileen, Christmas, 1986. On the inside of the only book my dad gifted me, it reads, "Property of Balbriggan Library." Before long, I graduated to books me and my Ma could both enjoy. The 80s was a bit of a golden era for children's literature, the genre finally having escaped the twee, patronising and prescriptive tone that dominated decades prior. First the Arabella Mortimer series, then Roald Dahl's children's books, both with appropriately wild illustrations by Quentin Blake. These provided the corpus for my first forays into literary criticism. Me and Ma would read these books, then discuss their respective merits and deficits in relation to other books by the same author. Without any concession to subjectivity, I'd rank them, not in terms of personal favourites, but definitively from best to worst. The Roald Dahl list went: number 1, Matilda; number 2, The BFG; number 3, The Witches; number 4, Danny the Champion of the World; all the way down to The Giraffe, Pelly and Me, for which I had an unreasonably vitriolic disdain. We'd also chat about the scenes or characters we loved or hated. Ma would always have them read first, because she had a habit of immediately snatching and reading in a couple of hours any books I was given or borrowed from the mobile library that used to visit the estate. She read with the determination, focus and singularity of purpose of an Olympic athlete. In the film The Social Network, about the genesis of Facebook, there's a scene that emphasises how immersed a computer programmer becomes when set to their task. "He can't hear you, he's plugged in," the Zuckerberg character explains. This didn't seem like such a strange phenomenon to me at all, because that's precisely how my Ma was with books. I remember the calf fruitlessly trying to get her attention, climbing into her lap and clawing at the tome she was plugged into. She'd simply move the book out of cat's reach without averting her eyes from the text, her brow still furrowed in concentration. I'd usually be on the floor reading a book of my own, but if I did want my Ma's attention, I'd have to employ similar tactics to the cat and try and remove her from whatever world she was immersed in. As I got older, the books began to flow in the other direction. I'd borrow hers. I remember in particular The Soul Brothers and Sister Lou, a cool, vibrant and wise young adult book detailing the experiences of inner city African-American teens struggling with the temptations of the street. It was rare to have such a strong young female lead character, especially one so focused on looking out for the troubled men in her life. In hindsight, it makes sense my Ma would identify with that. One of the greatest privileges of having a novel published myself was being given the opportunity to formally recognise in print those who'd helped me along the way. My acknowledgements end away. "Just as some crimes go unpunished, some bills remain outstanding. The dedication expresses a debt I could never hope to repay." That inscription itself, of course, simply reads, "For Ma, who else?"
Lovely story, Frankie. That was a lovely story there about the woman who inspired him in his life. And we've a song about a woman who inspired me, and the song is called "The Queen of Camden Street." One, two, three.
eyes swinging hands, the only girl able to stand without a crouching arch of pain in the spitting drizzle rain.
Imagine a young girl, 13 years old, on a day, any day, in 1650, intently studying a little paper house, an upside-down structure, not a toy. She's watching its residents, caterpillars, white in color. Unlike any other, the future artist and naturalist Maria Sebea Marian had previously seen. These silkworms were a surprise present. Native to China, such creatures had been for more than 3,000 years, the source of the fiercely protected secret cultivation of silk and thread. By the late 16th century, a handful of people in what would become southern Germany were also attempting to breed silkworms and had planted mulberry trees to provide the essential leaves. The pioneering entomologist, who would always insist she was not a scholar, was born in Frankfurt on April 2, 1647, 18 months before the signing of the Peace of Westphalia, which ended the 30 Years' War. Change was in the air. Europeans were becoming aware of distant places such as Virginia and Florida. Books were being printed showing maps of this exciting new world. Many of these books were published by her father, a Swiss artist and engraver, Matthias Marian the Elder. Books and engravings, paintings and prints dominated her home life. As a small child, she began sketching flowers. Her father died when she was only three. Yet his influence was already part of her very being. Her mother remarried. Her new husband was the German painter and art dealer, Jakob Marel, who specialized in still life, at times featuring fruit, though mostly flowers, tulips in particular. Little Maria loved her stepfather's paintings, and while her mother preferred the girl concentrate on needlework and cooking, Maria only wanted to paint. Quietly, with the calm deliberation which would define her personality, Maria painted in the attic. She stole a tulip from the garden of a nearby count. Her nocturnal theft thrilled her, and these nighttime raids continued until she was caught. So impressed was the aggrieved count with his intruder's paintings that he requested one by way of compensation. On discovering his stepdaughter's talent, Mariel invited her to join his studio. Her gift was instinctive and also inherited. What would set her apart, though, was that she examined the natural world at first hand. Many of her specimens were painted live instead of mounted on a display board. Through monitoring the development of the creatures she collected and fed, she witnessed the drama of metamorphosis. Her patience made her a skilled observer. She watched as caterpillars spun cocoons in September, from which many would emerge the following spring as butterflies, her summer birds. Andreas Graf had been her stepfather's favorite student. On his return to Frankfurt after 5 years of further studies in Rome and Venice, Maria was then 17. Within 12 months, they were married, and 3 years later, she gave birth to the first of two daughters. The family moved to Nuremberg, Graf's home place, an established center of printing and publishing. But Graf's art did not flourish. Marian had to work, decorating tablecloths with butterflies and flowers. She also taught embroidery and drawing to gentlewomen. All the while, she had been painting. Eventually, in 1680, three sets of floral plates, by then consisting of 36 works, were bound as a volume, the New Book of Flowers, and on its cover, the young Frau Graf, aware of her artistic heritage, described herself as the daughter of the late Matthias Marian the Elder. Producing beautiful, flamboyant, and accurate images of flowers did not deflect her passion for insects. The previous year had seen the publication of Caterpillars, Their Wondrous Transformation and Peculiar Nourishment from Flowers. Jakob Mariel's death in 1681 caused her to return to Frankfurt with her daughters to live with her widowed mother. Graf joined them later, but the marriage was already faltering. By 1685, the year of the birth of Johann Sebastian Bach, Marianne moved with her mother and children to a village in the Netherlands, to live in a Labadus community house in a supporter's castle. Her stepbrother Casper was already a member. He died the following year. Marianne worked on, devoting her labour to God. This unworldly attitude did not last. After the death of her mother in 1690, Marianne left the community and headed for Amsterdam, an exciting commercial capital of art, science, trade, and exploration. Her knowledge was recognized, although she never presented her work in Latin, the language of science. It was initially published in German or Dutch, depending on the market and her patron at the time. Life moved on. Having made her will and reverted to the name Maria Sabea Marianne, the artist-scientist sold off many paintings and specimens to travel to the then Dutch colony of Suriname in South America to study the butterflies and insects. She was 52, elderly by the standards of the time. Conditions were harsh on the two-month voyage. The tropical heat proved unbearable. For 2 years, Marianne explored, studied, and recorded with heroic zeal. David Attenborough regards her as a titan of natural history. Illness, probably malaria, forced her back to Amsterdam, bringing hundreds of butterfly specimens, as well as lizards, snakes, even a crocodile. Above all were the invaluable notes and drawings. Her Majestic Insects of Suriname was published in 1705 and remains a classic of natural history work. Among her admirers was Peter the Great, on whose behalf his physician, Robert Arkson, a Scot with an interest in natural history, had purchased some of her works for the Tsar and others for himself. On the day of her modest burial in a now-forgotten grave on January 17th, 1717, Arkison paid a large sum in exchange for Marianne's papers. Before Charles Darwin, before John James Audubon, before Alexander Humboldt, before Gilbert White, even before Carl Linnaeus, and long, long before Alfred Russel Wallace, a precise and determined German artist with an indomitable curiosity in the beauty and strangeness of the natural world, had watched and observed, unpicking nature's mysteries and opening the door for generations of naturalists who would follow.
I have moved house. I'm not far from the farm, but Vivian, my love, has come to be with me. And marrying some months ago, we've taken a place of our own. Luck or fate has brought us a house on the shores of Loch Gowna in rural Longford. It is a lake which I have known deeply since returning to Ireland 3 years ago. The Aboriginal peoples of Australia are divided into saltwater and freshwater peoples. The salt water being on the coast and the fresh water being inland. Loch Gowna has made me realise that I'm of the freshwater mob. Us Midlands people are landlocked, being some half an hour or an hour from the sea. But we have been blessed with lakes and in great abundance here, and it is to them that I come for restoration. I bought a new rod recently, and in the evenings I go down by the lake shore to fish. On one of the first evenings, as I held the line taut on my finger, just before I cast out, the wind blew, and I could hear the line sing in the breeze. It was a new sound to me, and a beautiful one, like some siren's call. I cast out, hoping this to be a sign of good luck, but though the lake is full of trout and perch, I caught nothing. Our neighbour, who owns the fields from which I fish, has 4 horses in it at the moment, and I stand and talk to them as I fish. They run and play by the water's edge, their manes blowing in the wind, like some scene from Tírnanóg. I look back at our little cottage and wonder what Vivian is doing. She is getting to know the country bit by bit, getting to understand us as a people. The Irish are a loose bunch, she says, to which she means they were all a sort of cowboys. I laugh and agree. We don't do things the right way all the time, but that's the joy of the place, I say. It is, she agrees and smiles. I can see where Australia got its sense of humour from, she adds. I put the rod to one side and strip down to take a short swim. The hot summer has warmed the cold lake, and it is quite pleasant. I have my goggles with me, and the water is clear, and I can see the shoals of baby fish on the shore, the weeds and mosses of the lake bed, and in the distance, what I think is a pike. Sometimes I am afraid that one of those monsters might come and bite me on one of these swims, but I do not think that I would be much eating for it. The horses stamp and neigh at the sound of my splashing, and after a good half hour, I return to the shore tired. I sit by the pebbles and look at the ancient forests on the far shore. It is one of the few old-growth habitats in the area, and a family friend has told me there are woodpeckers living there. The wood is nearly inaccessible, and so people do not go there, which suits the birds and trees just fine. It is beautiful. I look toward our cottage and see the lights of the kitchen on. It looks every inch the Irish postcard, except for the fact Vivian is cooking a Vietnamese dish her mother has taught her. It is modern Ireland. I walk back through the horses and long summer grass, my fishing rod over my shoulder. Back to my wife. That is a phrase I am still getting used to.
Thanks very much.
Hello. Lovely stuff from John. When I was still in school, in secondary school, I used to play at wedding ceremonies all the time. It took off. Every weekend I was away playing at wedding ceremonies. Even I had to walk out of the middle of my biology exam during the Leaving Cert to go play at a wedding. And I passed. It's the only thing I passed. Then I went off to the States for 10 years and I came back to Ireland and I thought I'd be able to pick up where I left off with the wedding music, but no. But I'm glad to say that I'm in demand for funerals. I'll be taking bookings after. So without further ado, I'll play some funeral music for you. And I'll sprighten it up a little bit at the end with a Breton wedding march for John. So it's oft in the stilly night, I play a verse of Shae Ma Leach Ma Gile Mar, or Shave My Legs, as they call it down West Cork. And on Dro de Petit Bateau.
I was hooked from the start on songs in the Seán Nós, those old songs in the Irish language which are sung a cappella, having been passed down from generation to generation. We had a small collection of vinyl records at home, issued by Gaeling in the 1960s and 70s, that I used to play again and again. I'd put the record player to the correct 45 RPM setting and listen intently, trying to learn the phrasing, the words, the breathing, and the various ornamentations. I listened to Lauros Draper singing Róisín Dóibh and An Gortaíonn Uaireanán, and then I turned the record over to the B-side and listened to him singing Spalpín a Rún and An Buachaillín Bán. For a brief period, I used to go down to Anne Mulqueen, the great traditional singer from Castle Connell in County Limerick, who lived with her family at the foot of our village in Ballinangaul in the Ring Gaeltacht. She taught me Róisín Dóibh, singing it phrase by phrase while the two of us sat in her kitchen, her children playing around us, flames from the fire roaring up the chimney. One of my earliest performances of this song nearly put an end to my singing endeavours. However, as I prepared to make my debut singing at an end of summer concert in our local Coláiste na Ringa, I walked up and down outside the old Cayley Hall in the fading sunlight, feeling by turns excited, terrified and nervous. I was about 12 at the time. I was listening to the performances that were taking place inside when, to my horror, I heard the voice of the renowned Seamus McGovern starting out on the first long notes of Róisín Dubh. Ah, Róisín, na bíoch brón ort, na cásanéis. And my heart broke. I stood rooted to the spot. How could I ever go on after that? He was singing my song, and I couldn't stem the tears that ran down my cheeks, nor could I stop the fright that gripped me. I was devastated, completely deflated, and unable to go on that night. It was a blow, but I survived, and I lived to sing again. These songs are often difficult to learn, but I'd persist. I'd sing along with Seán O'Shea and his recording on another Gaelic single of Táim Sim Chula. I loved these songs because my father, a great Waterford man, loved them, and he loved to hear me sing them. So in spite of the dread and shyness that envelops all teenagers at being asked to step forward, I was often propelled to the centre of the room at parties or sessions and expected to perform. My father would swell with pride when I stood forth, and a hush would fall on the room. I'd often come a cropper, scaling some of those notes, but over the years I became more confident, and my technique improved, and I'd sing these arias of the Gaelic world whenever I was asked. I was always hooked on the much-loved song Na Conairis, about the three brothers from Bohadún, tenant farmers who were banished to New South Wales for standing up for their rights in the pre-famine days of unjust landlords. Prisun Clún Mala was another song about agrarian revolt that I loved, especially the gory lines that described the man sitting in jail awaiting his execution, thinking about how his head would be put on a spike and hung outside the prison to rot along with two other men. In my 20s, in Mooney's, our local pub, I was occasionally asked to sing, and I loved to be included. Over the years, I had grown brave, and often, in the course of an evening, I'd await my turn, peppering and thrilled as my chance to sing drew nearer. On being asked, I'd bank down the nerves, compose myself, and start out on the first lines of An Buachalín Bán, Spalpín Arún, or my father's favourite, Slíobh Gal Gu. I loved being there in the small side of the pub, all of us squashed in together, listening to, almost living within the music. But one night, after returning home, my two sisters tried to explain something that didn't seem quite right to them. Don't be so eager, they advised. I should hold back a little sometimes, they said. And I did. And I do try to rein myself in and disguise my eagerness. Now I'm older, and occasions to sing don't happen that often. But recently, at a family gathering, my cousin, Donal Musgrave, asked me to sing, and I did. I sang An Gortaíonn Uaireanán, which is about a love-struck young man who is bereft without the girl of his dreams. I sang it lightly, as I was among those I loved. I didn't try to impress or impose my voice. I began quietly, sweetly, and I held my nerve. I remembered all the words. I didn't get lost in the lines, and I was given a generous round of applause at the end. As the faces around me nodded in appreciation, I knew my father would have been delighted. And when Donal told me that my grandmother, Katie Foley, used to sing this very song, well, I felt as if it was all meant to be.
Tis Mary of Galair, Shinga Corfern and Asia, Hagas Homi Kun, Aron Arodi Vinish, Alug, Catherine and Sonny Sluha. We're going to sing you a song that Catherine mentioned in her piece, just there, Shli of Galgua, or Shli of Galgua na Fela. When we started out as a choir nearly 10 years ago, an all male choir, we were compared to the Chippendales. And as we took off our coats and fleeces there at the wings, Lorcan made reference to the fact that, remember the time we were called the Chippendales, but now looking at the group behind me, I think we were a bit of wax in the ear. We misheard what they said, and I think the reference was to Clydesdales. So we're making a new Budweiser ad for Christmas. Cárach on the far left is going to hit the tree with his hip. And sure, who knows, but Shlí of Galgua na Féile, written by Padraig O'Malley from Shlí of Gua beside Tuairneana, a song he wrote in a time when he left Tuairneana while he was living in Wales. And it makes account of the beautiful area, the people, the language, and how he misses it. Sure, I'll give Shlí of Galgua na Féile.
Alliof gael gwan y ffeile Ys ffad y wyt i gen y me Ym o hi cos gwan y maenol Gotrelog ffeile
Hares. I saw three hares that year. The first, Convent Garden Scavenger. The second, on Tullibard's Hill. The third appeared one winter's night in my father's haggard, its eyes lit by the headlights before it blinked and bounded through the cowshed door. In the house, there was fire in the grate, barm brack on the table, weak tea in the pot, and I reported on the hare, while my father, frail by then, helped my mother remember old talk of a hare, white as milk, soul hunter, banshees familiar. Before I left, I took a torch to the outhouses and found the hare crouched in an empty stall, still as death, glassy-eyed, resolute. I backed away.
It was the summer of 1992. My family lived in Thornton Heath, Croydon, South London. Mommy was very proud that she had a daughter going to Trinity here in Dublin. At every family wedding, funeral and christening, she would brag, "My daughter is in the university." At 22, Mommy's outburst would make me cringe. My sisters ran show to our extended family. Weddings were organised with my sister's and mother's approval. If the Bures were not happy, there would be no arrangements. The Myers were our neighbours. They were Asian, originally from Pakistan, and like the McDonoughs, the Myers had a large family. They had daughters and sons who were ready and wanting to be married. Their rituals and customs were similar to ours. We loved the Myers. Our ways and their ways were normal to both families. My mother and Mrs. Meyer were very close friends. They spent most of the time sewing, while complaining about the wildness of their daughters and the laziness of their husbands. They sent us food, chicken biryani, beef tahari and red chilli chutney, and always took our offerings of soda bread, spuds and cabbage. We were pretty sure they wouldn't enjoy our grub as much as we did theirs. In the back garden, we would hear the Meyer girls dancing to pop music. Then Mr. Meyer would be shouting and Hindi music would fill our ears. Drying my long hair in the sun, laughing with my sisters, who would be giddy dancing to the kitsch Irish country music that we had blaring. My father would change the noise to traditional Traver songs. The Meyers were always having family celebrations. My mother would sit among Mrs. Meyer and her female relatives. The women would tire themselves out with all the talking. If the speech slipped into Hindi, apologies were made to my mother. Both women had much in common. They supported and influenced each other. There was a knowing, a humanity, and an acceptance that filled the space between them. That summer, to the outside world, my focus was on my studies. And my mother was no fool. She knew there was a sadness around me. Watching my siblings make lives for themselves, my mother knew my turn for love would come. Imran Maya, his dark hair and eyes. He was like me, cynical and insecure. The wheelchair thing was going on for the both of us. My sisters would tease me over him. And me, hiding away, speaking in whispers, always in fear of ridicule and humiliation, hating who and what I am. Shame shadowed, had a voice in my head. Internalized ableism and racism created conflict inside of me. Am I too disabled? Slipped off my tongue easily and frequently. In a public space, in a street, in a shop, anywhere and everywhere, the need to minimize, control and contain myself was ever present. Other disabled people triggered my awkwardness. Denying my traveler identity stole my pride. The effort of trying to be normal was isolating, painful and lonely. Our mothers hatched a plan. Mommy did her best to build my confidence and self-esteem. To please her, I agreed to go to my cousin Nancy's engagement in the clock tower. She persuaded Daddy to let me, insisting that my independence was of equal value to everybody else's. Often I think about that conversation, how difficult it must have been for my parents. Irish travellers of a certain generation, living in London, imagining the best for all of their daughters, including the one with cerebral palsy. Their instinct might have been to use traveller culture to preserve specific gender roles for women. The pressure they must have been under, to be afraid of my future. Resisting the trap of controlling or overprotection. What strong and intelligent people they were. Our Nora dressed me. My hair was washed and oiled. Heavy smoky eye makeup was applied. Our Kathleen shoved a long skirt on me, which was removed 5 minutes from the house, revealing a tight, short mini. That Friday night in the clock tower in London, the music was loud and wild. All kinds of bodies, skins, nationalities and ethnicities were gyrating. It was an 80s night. Punk was not my scene. It was too edgy and subversive. The floor cleared. Imran moved towards the empty dance space, looking at me. He dared, challenged and seduced. Moving very slowly, my muscles responded to the rhythm of Spasticus Autisticus by Ian Dury, a protest song against the patronising of disabled people. It would later be banned by the BBC. That dangerous music reverberated through our bodies. We danced in public like our lives depended on it.
Thank you. On this morning's programme, a selection from past live shows in the Civic Theatre Talla and the Theatre Royal Waterford, we heard Books, My Ma and Me by Frankie Gaffney, The Stolen Tulip by the late Eileen Battersby, A New Home by John Connell, Shannon's Singing was by Catherine Foley, Hares, a poem by A.M. Cousins, and Synergy by Rosaline McDonough, read by Catherine Murphy. The music was The Queen of Camden Street by The Finns, Beatus Vir Qui in Sapienta Morba Tour by Orlando Lazos, played on alto flute and bass clarinet by Susan Doyle and Deirdre O'Leary, A Stilly Night Medley by Donal Clancy on guitar, Sliabh Heal Guana Féile by Padraig O'Melia, sung by Cór Fear na n-Éisce, directed by the Ron O'Drumma, and the soloist was Cormac McCrea. A Stoir Mo Chrí, played on Tin Whistle by David Power, and Piazzolla's Libertango, played by the Far-Flung Trio, Catherine Hunke on violin, Dermot Dunn on accordion, and Malachy Robinson on bass. The Redline Book Festival continues today at the Civic Theatre in Talla. See redlinefestival.ie for details. And Waterford Writers Weekend takes place next weekend in Waterford and Dungarvan. The full programme is at waterfordarts.com. And another literary event, live event, you might be interested in. The stories from this year's RTE short story competition in honour of Francis McManus are currently going out on air on Late Date here on RTE Radio 1, leading up to the awards night, which takes the form of a live special arena programme from the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary this Friday, the 24th of October at 7 p.m. Ricochet will be joined by judges Jan Carson, Neil Hegarty and Tristan Rosenstock. And there'll be performances from all the stories and live music from David Kitt before the announcement of the top prizes. Tickets are available at pavilliontheatre.ie. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back to the programme on the RTE radio player or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.